we can just jump right in. So start with, quick overview of kind of your research and your work. Again, I'm not an expert on antitrust, so I'm going to be learning some of these things for the first time. But what, in sort of a brief overview way, are coordination rights?
So to kind of give a definition, I would say that coordination rights are the legal permission or support to coordinate economic activity. In other words, any process within production, distribution, commerce, or bargaining over any aspect of those processes, either within, or sorry, either in cooperation with others or by exercising authority over others. So to give some concrete examples of economic coordination rights, those might include the legal permission to engage in price setting, joint bargaining over what? Over prices, or over any other term or condition of a contract or a relationship, an economic relationship. Could include market allocation arrangements, and it could include even more fundamental decisions about the employment or disemployment of resources in sort of in economic processes and the organization of production or distribution processes. So that might still sound a little bit abstract, but I assume we'll, you know, get into some more examples as we go. But I think it might be useful to say up front kind of what the point of this concept is, or introducing this idea. And I think that the point of it is that all of these different types of processes, all of these different types of economic coordination that occur in the economy all the time, they have different legal forms. Some of them may not have a recognized legal form, but many have a legal form. Perhaps it's a legal form that is disfavored or even criminal. Others may, you know, may have a very favored and legitimized legal form. But regardless, many have legal forms. And what those legal forms, I think, lead us to do is to put kind of what can be substantively similar economic and social activity into very different kind of mental categories, such that it actually becomes harder to see the similarities between them. And so what do I mean by these legal forms? So those legal forms could include things like a firm, a corporation, a joint bargaining agency, a labor union, a producer's cooperative, a contract, the employment relationship itself, and perhaps even many property rights could be thought of in terms of coordination rights. So that is the general concept. And then to apply that to antitrust law, which is kind of probably a lot of what we're going to be talking about, my thesis is that antitrust law allocates economic coordination rights, and that this is actually fundamentally what it does. Other areas of law do this too, as I kind of adverted to, you know, with those different examples. But with antitrust law in particular, this proposition that it allocates coordination rights runs a little bit against the grains of our intuitions. And why is that? Because we might think that what antitrust law primarily does is just promote competition. And what I would say about that is that promoting competition, promoting business rivalry, might be one of the criteria that antitrust law uses when it allocates coordination rights, making sure that there is that healthy level of business or market rivalry. But even then, at the most fundamental level, what it's doing is choosing forms of coordination, choosing forms of competition. So again, the thesis is that antitrust law's core function is to allocate economic coordination rights to some economic actors and to deny them to others. And what that means, if you do end up accepting that, what I think that means is that it makes private decisions to engage in economic coordination subject to public approval. Rather, that is already happening. But if you accept that premise, then you're also accepting that what are often characterized as private decisions to engage in economic coordination, in fact, are subject to public approval, which antitrust law grants either expressly or tacitly, or it denies the right to do that. And so, again, as a result, what that means is that for all economic coordination that occurs, it's always either authorized by antitrust law or not. And so for any given instance of economic coordination, and certainly for any given instance of economic coordination that implicates prices, antitrust law asks either explicitly or implicitly whether that coordination is justified, legally justified, and then answers that question one way or the other. So that would be the sort of, I think, bigger overview of the concept and its application to antitrust law.
Yeah, it's really interesting. It's like, it's really interesting way to kind of take a step back and look at the economy sort of at a basic level. Cool. So then my next question is, how does, and you started to touch on this, I guess, but how does current antitrust policy use this concept of coordination rights to favor larger corporations over small businesses and workers, or does it, I guess?
Yeah. No, that's a great question. So I would answer that question by saying that currently as a whole, so obviously there is, you know, I'm making to some extent generalizations across a whole area of law, and there's going to be some exceptions to this. But overall, I would say that antitrust law tends to allocate coordination rights across doctrinal areas, so sort of doctrinal areas within antitrust, according to criteria that systematically prefer concentrated control over dispersed cooperation. Just another way to put that is that there's just a substantive preference, a kind of across doctrinal areas within antitrust, for control over cooperation, or to put it in terms of the central concept here, there's a preference for concentrated coordination rights over dispersed coordination rights. Because if you are, like, it's kind of obvious, but just to explain it, if you're concentrating coordination rights, you're concentrating them in a relatively few hands, right? And that, when you're doing that, we call that control, right? We ask about that, as you know, in various legal tests, like, is one party controlling the other, right? But really, what you could describe that as, if it's legally backed, is that it's a concentration of coordination rights. On the other hand, if the law or, you know, law and kind of social processes in a given area are dispersing coordination rights, then they are spreading them across a relatively larger number of actors, of firms, people, ultimately, right? And that means you have more people engaging in economic coordination, and that looks more like what we call cooperation. It's more horizontal and less vertical, right? And so I would say that right now, across sort of different doctrinal areas, antitrust has this preference for control over cooperation and for concentrated coordination rights over dispersed ones. And a few, just to kind of descend another level of abstraction, some of those specific doctrinal areas include antitrust conception of the firm, which we can talk more about if you want, but sort of how antitrust conceives of the firm, because it's not sort of just that any group of people engaging in any economic activity can simply incorporate or, you know, register with the state in some other way, like as a partnership or something else. And then as a result of that, as a result of that act under, under business associations law, that they can just immunize whatever economic activity they're engaging in under antitrust law. That's not the case, right? So antitrust has its own conception of the firm, which goes with sort of this, what I call the firm exemption to antitrust law, right? Which is namely that what if you are a firm, then antitrust, you know, if you being a group of people are a firm, then you get to engage in all kinds of things for antitrust purposes that you would not get to engage in if you were not considered a firm for antitrust purposes. But the thing that I'm sort of further saying is that the specific conception of the firm that antitrust law has is one that prefers control over cooperation. That those literally are the criteria. And to figure that out, you look at this kind of like obscure area of case law that may not have that much application on its own, but that really, I think, explains what antitrust law is doing here across a broader area. So, and that area of law is called the single entity doctrine. So that area actually tells us, you know, what counts as a single entity for antitrust purposes. A single entity, then there is no coordination there for antitrust law to recognize. It won't, you know, it's not going to pierce that veil of that entity to look at the coordination that's going on in there. And those cases, probably the key cases there are Copperweld and American Needle, a more recent case. Both are Supreme Court cases, one from the 80s and one from just I think about exactly when American Needle is from, but it's within the last 10 years or so. And that second case actually involved the NFL's attempt to pool its intellectual property. And specifically it's, you know, the use of team logos on merchandise. So that sounds, I know that sounds kind of arcane and like it has nothing to do with economic inequality and workers, but it really does, because that conception of what an entity is and thus of what a firm is under antitrust law really then says like who gets to avail themselves of these kind of the most privileged coordination rights under antitrust law, which I think is under the firm exemption, and who doesn't. And you can kind of already tell from how I describe, and so in both of those cases, the court sort of explicitly kind of says like that there's that we will recognize that there's a firm here when there is sort of top-down control from a concentrated center of decision-making. And they found that that did exist in Copperweld and that it did not exist in American Needle, the NFL case. You know, and so that coordination that the NFL teams were trying to engage in wasn't immunized. Okay, we may say we don't really care about these NFL teams engaging in this coordination, but that also then becomes applicable potentially to something like a producer's cooperative or a worker's cooperative, which is going to involve more dispersed coordination. That's the whole idea of it, right? Like the whole idea of it is that the coordination is more dispersed, it's more cooperative. Right. Yeah. And there's really this basic strain in antitrust law that I think militates against that. So that was a really long answer, but so that's one sort of important example is antitrust conception of the firm and its firm exemption. I'll just briefly mention a couple of other areas, but I won't go in depth into those. We can talk about it more if you want. The other areas would be antitrust law's treatment of horizontal coordination beyond firm boundaries. Mm-hmm. And there, antitrust law sees this, and that's commonly called price fixing, right? Like, so if antitrust law, sort of contemporary antitrust law, antitrust jurisprudence has actually dubbed this the supreme evil of antitrust. That's a quote from a Supreme Court case called Trinco that deals with another issue, but it's comparing actually the issue that it was dealing with to price fixing and, you know, sort of saying like, that's the supreme evil. And so I won't go too deeply into this here, but you can kind of just right away see how if you care about workers' rights and small, you know, small firms' rights and just smaller actors in the economy, that this is often not going to favor them because they are smaller actors. And so they're going to, you know, they're engaging in cooperation to stabilize wages, to stabilize prices, to to do any of those things, that potentially becomes price fixing, right? And then the other two areas, really briefly, the third one would be vertical coordination beyond firm boundaries. And this is what we call, in antitrust talk, we call that vertical restraints. But basically what it is contractual relationships between firms that are not in the same market, but in adjacent markets. So some examples of that would be a supplier relationship, a distributor relationship, a buyer relationship, you know, of a particular firm, like those contracts that a firm engages in with its suppliers, with its buyers, with its distributors. Those are all vertical coordination through contract. And we start to call them vertical restraints. That becomes a question, whether it's an impermissible restraint or not. But the point, really briefly, is that antitrust law is really far more accommodating of these vertical restraints than it is of horizontal coordination. And that reflects exactly that same point that I said to you under the first example, the first doctrinal area, which was the firm exemption or antitrust conception of the firm with Copper Weld and American Needle, because again, antitrust prefers that concentrated control over that dispersed coordination. So you kind of see,
to just see if I'm understanding it,
one
firm could set the prices for, and they own whatever, 25% of the market. Mm-hmm. They could set the prices for 25% of the market, but several smaller firms that own a much smaller percentage of the market collectively couldn't coordinate with each other.
That's absolutely right. And that's an example of the firm exemption, that sort of first, you know, and that's kind of the most basic and the one that is, once people see it, it's the most obvious thing in the world, right?
Yeah.
But it actually takes sometimes for, especially for folks who are more, you know, immersed in this area of law sometimes or in competition policy to actually see it, because it's almost like too obvious. It's right in front of your eyes. But yeah, so that's exactly right what you're saying. So that, but then I would go to just use your example to illustrate the second two.
Yeah, the vertical.
Yeah, yeah. So that same firm that owns, you know, or that has 25% of that market, right?
Yeah.
Let's just increase that. Let's say that they have like 60% or something, you know, so they're a pretty dominant actor.
Yeah.
And then they have distributor and supplier relationships. Like they are buying from suppliers and then they also are, you know, have distributor relationships. And they, and let's assume that their suppliers in this instance are more atomized. Like they are not big firms. They are smaller. Mm-hmm. Maybe they're artisan workers. Maybe they're small farmers. You know, it could be a variety of things. And in that situation, that relatively dominant actor, right? And like, it may have, we're kind of constructing this example, so we are making some assumptions here. So just, you know, just kind of go along with me with the assumptions, but obviously we would need more facts to really show this. So in a lot of these circumstances, though, that buyer is going to, you know, particularly if they control 60% of that market that those sellers are selling into, they are going to have quite a bit of power to set prices, and to set other terms and condition, you know, terms and conditions of the contract with those suppliers, and potentially also with their distributors. It really depends. This can run both ways. So I'm giving the example of a more powerful buyer, but it could also run the other way. You could have a powerful oil company that's a powerful seller, and they could have a bunch of individual gas station owners who are not powerful, you know, and they could be putting restraints on them. So just to finish that example, antitrust law will tend to say that those type of vertical restraints, which tend to, big caveat here because there are exceptions to this, but vertical restraints often are imposed by more powerful actors on less powerful actors. The antitrust law has a strong tendency to legitimize that type of coordination because it says that it's efficient. And I won't go more into that because that is a bigger question that you may want to ask about or not want to ask about. But it tends to say that there are efficiencies there. And so that's good for the economy. And so we're going to allow that, but that we're not going to allow those same small farmers to, and then again, there's exceptions because they're agricultural policy is actually a little bit of a different beast, and there are some exceptions, but in general, we're not going to allow the, you know, those small producers to coordinate among each other to, you know, in their dealings with that buyer. And so we can talk more about that. I would say that ultimately this doesn't make a lot of sense, but we have to go further in the argument to really show that. But you can see right away whether or not you think it makes sense that it clearly is legally reinforcing this preference for control over cooperation, and control can really only be exerted by the more powerful on the less powerful. That's how it works. That's what control is, right? And so you are legally reinforcing that relationship. And then super briefly, the fourth doctrinal area I would give an example of is, and this is kind of involved in the other three, but that so it's kind of more of like a meta observation, is that antitrust law also, I think, has this tendency to extend at least some property rights, to give deference to property rights in its allocation of economic coordination rights. And at the same time, to contemporary antitrust law, to refuse to enforce or extend customary rules of fair competition. And again, because that is something that I would say, and many others would say, antitrust law was traditionally designed to do, to basically ensure fair competition. I know we're going to talk more about that, but the contemporary version has a tendency to not do that, to refuse to enforce that, but to be quite deferential to at least many existing property rights. I'll stop there.
Got it. Well, yeah, let's just go into that concept of competition and fair competition and talk about how what is the conception of competition in antitrust law? Are there other focuses of antitrust law that might that you think would be better suited to address power imbalances? Or is there is there a different conception of competition than the one that's currently sort of used in antitrust law that is more like, is the problem with the idea of competition? I guess I'm asking kind of a series of questions there, is the problem with the idea of competition as the basis of antitrust law or is versus maybe like power imbalances or something like that? Or is there a better conception of competition that's worth pursuing?
Sure. No, great series of questions. So the fundamental point of, I think, this coordination rights frame, or one place that it leads to, is to I hope, the recognition that I would say it leads to this. I'm happy to be argued with on this. It leads to the recognition that actually simply saying that antitrust law promotes competition, it's not that I'm arguing against that by saying that that's bad, that it's bad because it ignores inequality. I happen to think that current antitrust law does promote inequality, and I know we're going to talk more about that, but that's not actually the argument here. The argument is that this is analytically empty. You cannot just say that antitrust law promotes competition because it doesn't. It allocates coordination rights. It currently allocates coordination rights more to the powerful than the less powerful, right? And it justifies that on the basis of economic efficiency, not on the basis of promoting competition, right? But it's all the fundamental point of the coordination rights critique is to say that competition policy, antitrust law, is always making decisions about what forms of coordination are permitted and what forms aren't, because there is no such thing as an economy with no economic coordination, obviously, right? And so there's no such thing as maximally promoting competition. You cannot just say that the criteria is that we promote competition, because you have to make choices about economic coordination. And so you have to have criteria for doing that. And that's what antitrust law is doing. And then in that whole sort of second question you asked, we were going through those different doctrinal areas to kind of see how it, the criteria that they are, you, that, you know, that antitrust law is using, tends to promote economic coordination that is top down, that is hierarchical, that, you know, is control based as opposed to cooperation based, and less democratic as opposed to more democratic. And so I just don't think you can say that it promotes competition. Here's what I do think you hear, but now to, that's my, like, you know, sort of line in the sand, but then to like complicate that a little bit, I do think, and I referred to this a little bit when we were first talking, I do think that the concept of healthy business rivalry is a real thing. Like, sort of like, right? So like, if you, do you have like one butcher in town or two? Like, that's a real difference, right? Or like, do you have, you know, do you have one tech company doing X, Y, and Z, or do you have two, right? That is a real, you know, whether you think that's important or not, there's people out there who, you know, including on the left, who do not think that that's important, and that, you know, that that's an important debate to be had. Mm-hmm. But I think it's true that that's a real thing in the world, right? But that itself is, first of all, not how the term competition is used in contemporary neoclassical law and econ antitrust law world. That's actually not how it's used. It's used in a way that is really tied up with this concept of economic efficiency, which owes itself to, ultimately, to Ronald Coase, this famous economist who, you know, wrote a number of famous papers, and, you know, comes up in law school all the time, as you probably encountered. But that concept of economic efficiency is itself internalizes those ideas of hierarchy and control, I would say, because ultimately these, and so I'm simplifying a little bit to just kind of make the point, but ultimately I would say that this concept of economic efficiency is itself running together a couple of different things. It's running together the idea that control is more efficient. So sometimes it might really be true, right? Like, so if we are in a class, there might be times that it's just easier for me as a teacher to say that, you know, this is what we're doing, and we're not going to take a poll about it, and we're not gonna, you know, and it's just what it is. And that might be more efficient in terms of saving time and energy and all of that, right? And then other times we might want to be more democratic or whatever. And that that might just be a legitimate question, right? Yeah. And then this is where the teaching analogy kind of breaks down, because we're not like producing a product for market. But if I were a boss, and, you know, so that same point could apply in a factory setting or a production setting. Like, there's just things that it just doesn't make sense to waste time like having meetings about, right? Mm-hmm. We can all sympathize with that. But there is a basic ambiguity, and I would say an inability, within the conceptual resources of neoclassical law and economics to actually make a distinction between that, like those types of like truly we are just saving time and energy through, in this case, a control-based process, to make a distinction between that and the situation where actually what's happening is economic domination and extraction, right? So the efficiency is coming from the fact that I am squeezing the small, I am a powerful distributor who is able to name my price to these small farmers, or is able to name my price effectively and tell exactly what to do to my distributors if I'm the oil company, and therefore I'm able to get more work out of them for less, right? Like, that's economic extraction. And that, you know, we generally tend to think that that's not good up to the limit, like, right? Like, that there's some fairness involved in what would be a fair price for whatever, right, what it is. And that beyond that, that's not efficiency, that's just unfairness, right? And I think that contemporary antitrust law has no space to make that distinction, because it says that the idea of fair price or fair competition is old-fashioned and silly and unscientific, and so we need to get rid of all of it. And this is, now we're hitting upon a basic debate that's happening currently, I think, in antitrust, because there are a lot of reformers who do not see it that way, right? But to just come back and just tie up this point, within the language of economic efficiency itself, my point is that there is no space to make that distinction between economic extraction and exploitation and just like genuine cost savings from doing things more efficiently, which, by the way, sometimes might be realized through democracy. Because while, you know, to take this again, not exactly the same type of economic example, but sometimes it's more efficient for me as a teacher to just tell everybody what to do. But sometimes it's actually more efficient for me to like hear what's happening, because there's information that people have that I do not have, because they're like in the breakout rooms or, you know, whatever it is, right? And that similarly that the small farmers have, or that the workers have, that the person in the boardroom doesn't have. And so it's not always the case that control is more efficient according to that more operational sense anyway. And so I know I keep saying I'm gonna wrap up, but like, but to just on your question about competition, I would say that A, just saying you're gonna promote competition is analytically empty, and that's not what antitrust law does anyway. Currently it's making decisions on this other set of criteria, if anything based on economic efficiency, and that concept of economic efficiency favors control. It does so in a way that cannot distinguish between true efficiency and extraction or domination, and so then what can we do instead? So I would say that what we should do instead is a couple of things. I think that we should explicitly, I mean, we would have to like see if everybody agrees on this, but you know, I would propose that what we do is to some extent reverse that preference for control over cooperation, that we should actually prefer more democratic allocations of coordination rights over less democratic ones. That should be the default, with the exception that I do think operational efficiency is important. So like true efficiency, like none of us want to sit in 3-hour consensus meetings about everything, right? And so, and so that there is a place for, you know, for less democratic decision-making at times, but reverse the default, right? Like it's currently, we are way out of whack in the other direction. And then secondly, really truly reintroduce this concept of fair competition, because once we recognize that there is no such thing as promoting competition in the abstract, you're always, you know, choosing some forms of competition and not other, choosing some forms of coordination and not others, then you can say like, because the problem with the current paradigm is it doesn't admit that. And so a lot of what we've been talking about, it's not just out on the surface. You have to excavate to like kind of get to the critique. And so instead what's said is that, no, this is all just like sort of shown by economics, right? Right. When I don't think that's the case, you know, like there are normative criteria that are driving these. And I think there's totally a role for empirical economics here to like look, you know, actually look at where are the efficiencies, where aren't there, but not for this theory, not for the economic theory that I think is just reproducing these normative preferences that we should be debating as a society, and everybody should have a say in that, not just economists and frankly, not just lawyers either. Like everyone who participates in the economy should have a share in that. But once we do that, then we're free to say that we as a society would like other criteria, not, you know, we would like criteria of fairness to decide what competition is legitimated and which isn't.
Got it. Yeah. So it's almost like there are two buckets in a way that like that some things actually may be more efficient or productive if we were to allow, you know, more fair competition or you know, disperse the coordination rights.
Yes. Yes.
That's one area that doesn't maybe even require like a ideological change, just
exactly
focus on efficiency and productivity. And then there's another area where things that may make things less quote unquote efficient or productive but still would be worthwhile to
disperse
for, you know, then you're into an ideological conversation about what's worth sacrificing some of that efficiency for.
I think that's true. Except I think the one kind of not even caveat, but just like addition or complication I would add to that is that that I think that this concept of efficiency as it's being used now is so muddled that it's not just talking about we could call it, you know, technical efficiencies, or I tend to say operational or productive efficiencies. It really wraps up already with economic extraction, certainly as it's used with, with the idea of vertical restraints. And I mean, to maybe get into a few more concrete examples, which you're probably wanting to do, like you really see that in the current debates and literature about tech platforms and the gig economy. Because a lot of what's happening there is that there you have dominant actors that are placing restraints, you know, often over prices, but also over lots of other things, on other actors that are in their kind of economic orbit, which includes workers, and it also includes very small businesses. And I think it's also important to note that when you're dealing with countries in the global south, so if you, it's interesting when you're talking about like Amazon in India, for example, there is like a whole movement of, I think, vendors and producers that sell on Amazon. And in the global south, there actually are a lot more artisans and really, you know, truly small farmers still, which we have here too. But as a more quote developed country, we've gone through a lot of changes where that, you know, it used to be in the 19th century that was actually the majority of the U.S. economy, and that's still the case to some extent, or at least it's a much larger sector in a lot of other economies. And in that situation, it's very, very difficult to even make a distinction between a worker and a small business, frankly. You really are working class if you're doing that. And so what these tech platforms are doing are you know, putting these vertical restraints that the overall paradigm of antitrust law sees as efficient. And again, it sees them as efficient in this kind of muddled way that I think blends together technical efficiencies with economic extraction. And that's kind of like where we are at today, I think, in debates over big tech, but way beyond big tech as well, I would say.
Yeah, for sure. Well, that actually kind of comes, I think we've kind of discussed a lot of the other questions, and the only one that I don't think we have really touched on, I guess we have, but maybe is worth like making a little clear is the question of like how these things have the day-to-day impact of these things on working class communities. I mean, I think we got to it, you're getting to it a little bit in that last thing about the global south, but I'm curious also here in the United States and more broadly.
Sure, yeah. I think there's so many examples that it's almost like on one level, it's like every working class experience, I think, is touched by this.
It's the air that we breathe in the economy, basically, right?
Yes, because it's like, you know, I was reading this this book review recently, and as you may kind of know from just like following some of these debates, like I think one debate that occurs kind of on in more left and progressive circles today is, you know, sort of between the more Marxist or socialist reform view and then like the antitrust, among other legal reforms, being kind of the other camp. I mean, I tend to think that, you know, there's some real differences here, but I think there's a lot of differences that aren't really differences. And so this is an example that I'll give. So I read this great book review I haven't read the book yet, but the book is by apparently a Marxist historian giving a history of merchant capitalism. And I was just really struck. I thought the review did such a great job of showing how so there's these different accounts of what capitalism is, right? And so so to just kind of like boil this down for our purposes, one account of what capitalism is really, really focuses on the wage relationship and like the proliferation of the wage relationship that occurred during the Industrial Revolution. And of course, we talked about that at the beginning of employment law. But another kind of, you know, definition or conception of what capitalism fundamentally is really about, so historically, of sort of merchants sort of having these relationships of control and domination over producers. And And that was primarily not through the wage relationship. That was through other legal relationships such as credit and debt, perhaps through like ownership and rent and land, right? Like with tenant farmers, but also through the putting out system, you know, where those people weren't employees. And these, you can say this is just like a precursor to the wage relationship, except that's back where we are now with tech platforms and with vertical disintegration and with the proliferation of independent contractor work and with, And that's what vertical, so to like, convert it into, I was just thinking as I was reading this book review, like this is, you know, what this school of sort of history of capitalism is saying is that capitalism is all about vertical restraints. And the wage relationship is like one vertical restraint. I remember a student of mine, a couple of, not this last semester in the spring before, actually saying at one point, you know, well, employment is a vertical restraint. And I think that's exactly right. You know, it is one form of that. And so that's to give some, I think, content to the, like, it really is the air, it really is the foundation, not just the air, but the really the foundation. But then some more concrete examples of then even within that, you know, how this comes up all the time. I think just super briefly, I would mention two recent conversations that I have had or exchanges, and one was with a taxi driver in Los Angeles who works with a taxi company that's been around for quite a while in LA, you know, and of course is competing with Uber and Lyft, but, you know, has a pretty healthy share of the taxi market, which obviously has shrunk in recent years, but is that company is basically a worker-owned co-op. It, you know, that all the taxi companies in Los Angeles actually are co-ops, but some of those, you know, similar, you can't just say the legal form, right? Because some of those co-ops are in fact held by holding companies that own other big businesses in California or elsewhere, right? And so they're more investor controlled, and they're not really worker controlled. But this particular one really is. It really is sort of controlled, like the majority of the seats on the board are the drivers, et cetera, et cetera. But they're facing the competition from Uber and Lyft, right? And then also facing this attempt that's currently underway actually by the city of LA to engage in price deregulation. So currently, without getting too much, obviously these schemes get very complicated, but, you know, essentially there is public coordination of the taxi market, and that's true actually across, you know, that some form of public coordination of ride services has been traditional in the US kind of until Uber and Lyft staged this disruption, right? That occurred. And so in a sense, like I would say actually so if we want to think about this in terms of coordination rights, we had the public on some level help, you know, engaging in economic coordination to the benefit of a number of actors, to the benefit of consumers, you know, of also making sure that drivers are getting a fair price. They're not just, you know, going into debt working basically. You do that through different systems. You can do it through sort of direct price controls or price regulation, which is what LA, you know, still today has. You can do it through medallions, which is what New York City does. And then there are different approaches, and so there are no medallions in LA. But anyway, they're doing, you know, going through this price deregulation scheme. And so I was speaking with this driver who's also extremely knowledgeable about everything that is happening here. And it really, you know, sounded to me like this is the type of, you know, the law that the city is trying to implement is something that was, you know, is supposedly going to make taxis more competitive with Uber and Lyft, but in practice is just going to drive them out of business even more quickly, right? And I think fundamentally that idea, that concept trades on, and that's how it goes a little beyond antitrust law, because this isn't technically an antitrust issue, although there are some antitrust issues kind of on the margins, arguably. But I think it shows how this kind of conceptual framework, ideology that really is seated in many ways in antitrust law exists beyond it. Because I think there's this idea in the economic policy community that price regulation is generally bad, it's anti-competitive, right? And so it's just, you know, we should dismantle it, right? Whereas fundamentally, you're saying the city of LA should deregulate. Meanwhile, Uber in that same market in LA is essentially engaging in price regulation across its fleet of drivers, but it's just private venture capital controlled price regulation, right? And so I think, so anyway, we could talk more about that, but that example, that is, you know, is just, is a, you know, current example, I think, of how these different assumptions really do affect people's lives. And, you know, these people are either going to have a living or they're not, based on how this debate goes. Another example is that and so this is an example I've given before, but it's just, again, a conversation I've had recently, is port truck drivers in this instance, I heard from somebody, an owner operator in the New York, New Jersey ports, who is trying to organize with other drivers and to do so directly, because if you're going to argue that there's actually misclassification, et cetera, you have to go through, as you now certainly know, a whole set of legal hurdles that are complicated and lengthy and uncertain. And, you know, why shouldn't, and in this case, they also own their own trucks, so it's going to be a much harder a hill to climb, you know, to show that. And so he, you know, is trying to organize directly, and they've been really badly hit since the pandemic, which has affected them in a number of ways. But they are, you know, I mean, I literally heard from this person because they wrote to me and they said, you know, I read your paper and this is exactly what we're facing, and we need antitrust exemptions for port truck drivers. And really, I think I would say we need them for a whole host of those sorts of folks across the economy. Yeah. But that experience that he's reporting is directly under that second example I gave of horizontal coordination beyond firm boundaries, where we are, you know, disfavoring that, saying it's a price fixing, it's a crime, whereas we're, again, in that situation too, permitting all types of top-down coordination in the ports, you know, starting with the very powerful shippers, starting with the buyers here, Amazon and others, you know, big box stores, but also even the shipping companies as well.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Cool. Well, we're definitely over half an hour.